From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been another busy week in Georgia politics. Governor Brian Kemp has just announced his intention to seek a Medicaid waiver from the federal government. Meanwhile, legislators are a quarter of the way through the session, tackling issues ranging from the $27.5 billion budget to offshore drilling and its effect on the coast.
We need to do what we can to protect this wildlife in our ocean. So I'm against it. And if we need it one day, that's another thing.
Joining me in the studio for our weekly recap is GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler. He's got his bow tie on. Good morning.
Good morning. You can hear it through the radio.
You can hear it through the radio. Stephen, 10 legislative days have passed so far, 40 in total. You explained the strange math of days to us last week. House Speaker David Ralston said yesterday that if this were a football game, we'd be ending the first quarter. So what's the score?
Well, it's kind of like the Super Bowl on Sunday because not much has really happened on paper or really in practicality. So in the House, they've done some things to add some circuit court judges. There have been people honored. The doctor of the day has come up, different things like that. But no substantial legislation has made it through. In the Senate, they did pass yesterday this school bus bill, which we'll talk about a little later, that'll close a loophole for when you could pass a school bus with its lights on. And the budget has been presented. It's $27.5 billion, which includes things like a teacher pay increase, state employee pay increase, and a voting machine money to pay for updating Georgia's system.
So where are we with the budget process?
Well, there are different subcommittees that have been meeting to kind of parse out line by line their relevant sections of the budget. We should have sometime maybe this week or next week a vote on what's called the little budget, which is the amended budget that runs until July. And then at some point they have to pass the big budget, which is July 1st of this year to June 30th of next year.
Okay, so all that is churning through. One thing that did make it through is the proposal to name the Judicial Center that's being built downtown in Atlanta after former Governor Nathan Deal. Here is House Speaker David Ralston introducing it to the Rules Committee.
I bring before you today House Resolution 1, very simple resolution that will, as all of you know, in I think August, we will open the new Judicial Center down the street, a facility that's long overdue and resulted from the leadership of Governor Deal.
Now, one of the hallmarks of Governor Deal's tenure was criminal justice reform. So proponents thought that naming the building after him would be pretty much a shoo-in. Was that the case?
Well, yes and no. It did pass overwhelmingly, but not unanimously. There were two no votes in the House. One was Representative Matt Gertler, who always does stuff like this. He was the one no vote on Hurricane Michael funding and things in the special session. But a new freshman, Representative Moore, also voted no. And so, you know, it was one of those things that it's not really, it's a ceremonial vote more than anything. But what's significant about those two no votes is that there's a certain bill in the House that would provide constitutional carry, which means that people, their right to carry firearms and everything is provided by the Constitution. The first two signers on that bill, Representative Gertler and Representative Moore. So you can basically kiss that bill goodbye this session.
Okay, well, that's one. And the House and Senate have set the calendar for the rest of the legislative session. They're meeting virtually every day until April the 2nd. So it's pretty much a breakneck pace. What does that mean for the process of bills that are becoming law?
Well, for one, it means that I'm going to be very, very busy coming in here and talking about what's going on. But it's like a Beastie Boys song that I like, but instead of no sleep till Brooklyn, there's no breaks till April. So what that means on one hand is that it'll be a lot easier for things to slip by, you know, reading dozens of bills, voting on dozens of bills, things going forward. One day bleeds into the next one. Maybe easier for somebody to slip something in or pass a, you know, what's called like a placeholder bill that has a few lines of text that then they pass the bill. And then later on, once it gets later in the session, they'll substitute a completely new bill in. And because it already passed one chamber, it's easy to go through. But it could also mean, I'm hopeful, it could mean that there's a steady pace and momentum of bills being passed and discussed and voted on. And so we're not there on the last day of the session until 11:59 p.m. trying to just vote on numbers and things like that. Crossover Day is March 7th, and that's the day at which a bill has to pass either the House or the Senate to be considered for the rest of the session. So expect the end of February, beginning of March to kind of be off the chain of trying to negotiate and get things through.
So there are these committee work days. Why are they on the calendar?
Well, the work days are important because after crossover day, you know, the House passes a bill and then it goes over to the Senate. And the Senate may have their own version of the bill that they did or did not pass. And so these are days dedicated to sitting down and hashing out these differences because the House may want $5 for something and the Senate may want $3. And then they have to figure out whose version gets to go to the governor. So these are important work days. It's a sign from leadership of we've got to get stuff done, and it's going to be important, but that means there's going to be, you know, 10, 15 different committee meetings going on at once, all hearing important bills.
So it's tough to report on what's going on inside of the committees until things actually get to the floor. How do you get a beat on that?
Well, you know, the committees do post their agendas online of the bills that they're going to talk about. Usually it's just the bill number, so you have to know what the bill number is and what the bill is actually for. And, you know, because members are on multiple committees at once, you know, you're not going to have every single major bill in the world being heard at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. So it's important to kind of follow the committee players and the committee chairman and figure out what bills are happening to be able to know what's going ahead. Also, you know, there are a ton of lobbyists that hang around the Capitol waiting and getting messages. So if you see 500 people in one committee meeting room and five in the other, that's pretty much a good sign that there's something going on.
How about aside from listening to you and checking in with you, how can we as Georgians really keep tabs on the lawmakers?
So the House and the Senate do a really great job of updating things on their website. You can find all the bills there. You can find the status of whether they've been voted on, what committee they've been assigned to. You can watch all of the committee live streams. So if you really, really want to know what's happening in the Public Safety Committee next Friday, there's a live stream for that. So it's really, really accessible once you know where to look to find all of these things. And I think one way for the audience and the listeners to not be surprised if they pass a bill or do something like that, it's all there, and it's there for the taking and there for the looking at. But it is a bit overwhelming with, you know, several hundred legislators, several hundred bills, things like that.
I'm speaking with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler, who likes to keep his eye on these kind of things. Not everybody has that predilection. He's covering the State House and Senate during the legislative session, giving us regular updates of all things politic. This week, members of the Coastal Delegation held a press conference announcing two resolutions related to offshore drilling. Here is Republican Representative Don Hogan of St. Simons.
Our fishery industry depends on our coastal Georgia. The shrimping industry depends on us. The oyster industry depends on us.
Okay, so what does this pair of bills hope to accomplish?
So that was actually Democratic Senator Lester Jackson of Savannah. I got my offshore drilling clips mixed up there. But, you know, these pairs of resolutions aim to say that Georgia should be off limits when it comes to offshore drilling. Last year, the federal government opened things up on the Atlantic coast for drilling and exploration of drilling. But what you have is a bipartisan group of lawmakers from the coast and Atlanta and the mountains and everything saying that Georgia's coastal economy does not need offshore drilling and does not need these environmental impacts. And this resolution not just bans offshore drilling, but would require, like, even the testing for it, kind of the precursors of finding out if there's oil there. They say they don't even want that because of the negative effects it has on the environment. And Governor Kemp himself has said that he would fight this if need be to protect Georgia's coastlands. So it seems to be something that everyone's in agreement on.
Well, is that characteristic of Georgia lawmakers taking a stand for environment over business interests?
Well, I guess it depends. You know, a lot of people, as they mentioned in the press conference, you know, representatives said, you know, people vacation down there, people work down there, people live down there. So it's not just this abstract, you know, environmental thing of, oh, there's a rig 100 miles off from the coastline, and whatever people want to do, you know, it's got real environmental effects. And the coastline of Georgia, even though there's about 100 or so miles of it, a lot of people have a lot of strong feelings about it. And so this, I think, is an example of the environmental impact coming together and people, you know, coming together regardless of party to support something that they believe in.
Are we seeing other bipartisan pushes under the dome?
Well, I sure hope so. But what we have seen this session so far is, you know, maybe a bit tamer than what some people were anticipating after the bitter gubernatorial race and some of the other races. You know, somebody said that maybe the controversial bills were being held until after the Super Bowl and people stopped paying attention to Atlanta and Georgia. But, you know, some representatives and some senators are going to file things because they file things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going anywhere. But what you have seen is this increasing bipartisan push. You have in the Senate, you've had the issues with the women's issues and the Equal Rights Amendment come up, and you have this voting machine and voting security thing push that are coming from both sides trying to do things. So I think this first session, as people try to get settled with their grooves and settled with their alliances, you're seeing a lot more cooperation and kind of passive lawmaking as opposed to fireworks all the time.
Well, a big announcement that could start some fireworks from Governor Kemp last night. He says he's going to seek a federal Medicare waiver. Now, of course, heard rumblings about this kind of thing in the past. Many conservatives have remained against Medicaid expansion. What is he planning?
Well, so the bottom line, I think what both sides would agree is that some sort of plan like this wants to have more Georgians with more access to health care. And what that exactly looks like will be the political sticking point. In the governor's budget, he set aside $1 million for a consultant to explore the different waivers that are out there. And this is a waiver from the Affordable Care Act, from Obamacare, from these federal guidelines, kind of for Georgia to create its own pathway to ensuring more people. Now, Democrats believe that Medicaid expansion is the way to ensure more people and to expand what's already working. But Republicans say that Medicaid expansion in small amounts may be the solution, but they worry what happens if the federal government one day might not meet its commitment, and then the state is responsible for paying for all of that health care. So Governor Kemp next week is going to make some sort of announcement and big rollout and push, and I think he's going to have a listening tour of things. So this is something that lawmakers are taking seriously, but what the final product looks like remains to be seen.
All right. So you mentioned the Senate did pass one bill this week that undoes part of a change enacted last session specifying when it is legal to pass a school bus. Here's the bill's author, Republican Senator Bill Heath of Bremen, speaking about last year's mix-up.
The bill, House Bill 978, caused a problem that has put a lot of our children, our school age children, at risk in Georgia.
So what does this mean for safety of school children?
Well, so basically, last year, they passed a law that said that you can drive past the school bus with a stop arm out if you're on the other side of a road that's kind of divided either by a strip of grass or a concrete barrier, or a turn lane, either a reversible turn lane or another turn lane. And then lawmakers realized, and they heard from teachers and bus drivers and everything like that, that a turn lane isn't an actual physical barrier to keep cars from being out of the way. And if somebody's got to cross the street, there's no safe way to do it. So this was a way of kind of listening to feedback and kind of closing that gap to make it safer for children and school bus drivers. Because believe it or not, Virginia, there's still a lot of people that drive around school buses when there are children getting off in the arms there. So this clarifies that to keep children safe.
Well, Stephen Fowler, thank you so much for speaking with us. Next week, we will be speaking with you from Savannah. We will be at the Book Festival. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the music of worship became the devil's music. Well, that's at least what early critics of rock and roll feared. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll hear more about that when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. February is Black History Month, and today we are hearing about how the music that flowed from black churches influenced the likes of Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and contemporary artists like Chance the Rapper. Here's Blessings from his Grammy-winning rap album, Coloring Book. That song references Reverend James Moore's When the Praises of God Go Up, the Blessings Come Down. And it's the kind of musical lineage traced in gospel roots of rock and soul. It's hosted by Grammy Award-winning gospel musician Cece Winans. And this four-part series airs on GPB Radio starting this Sunday. Historian and founder of the Journal of Gospel Music, Bob Maravich, contributed to the project and is joining us from Chicago. Bob, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Virginia, for having me on the show.
I'm wondering, the blues, rhythm and blues, soul, these are generally thought of as earthy, maybe even lusty forms of music. And we've all heard sex and drugs and rock and roll. How does the music of praise come into all this?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, blues and R&B and soul got some of its earthiness from gospel. And gospel got some of its earthiness from the Pentecostal church. And all of it came from West Africa, ultimately, when enslaved Africans were brought here from that area. They brought their religion and the sound of their religion and really the sound of their culture with them.
Well, let's look at how that actually sounds. The radio documentary follows this evolution, and one of the first popular gospel songs made right here in Atlanta in 1947 by Leroy Abernathy. Let's hear just a little bit of Gospel Boogie.
Jesus isn't coming from his throne on high. Many are the weary and the lonely stare. They're gonna wish they hadn't done the things that they had. How you gonna feel about the things he'll say on that judgment day? Everybody's gonna have
religion. Abernathy was a white Southerner. Bob, were they playing this kind of music in white churches at the time?
They were. It was a sound called Southern Gospel. And so groups like Leroy Abernathy's group, I think it's the Homeland Harmony Quartet and the Statesmen and the Blackwood Brothers, they listened to black gospel quartets as black gospel quartets listened to the white quartets on the radio and learned from one another. So a lot of what you heard in that particular song came from the African-American quartet tradition. And then, interestingly enough, people like Sister Rosetta Tharpe, a very famous gospel singer, and the Pilgrim Travelers, a very famous gospel quartet, sang Gospel Boogie as well. So a lot of interplay between the two.
So that seems to characterize this evolution. Let's hear just a little bit. Pioneering Sister Rosetta Tharpe, you mentioned her. She brought electricity and energy to her rock gospel sound. Here's a little bit of Down by the Riverside, came out in 1949.
I feel so bad in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
I feel so bad in the evening.
In the evening.
That's why I'm going to the river to wash my sins away. I'm going to lay down my heavy load
down
by the riverside.
Down
by the riverside.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe there, she started in the Pentecostal church in her hometown in Arkansas, and her career really took off when she started playing nightclubs in New York City. So did she change the message of the music to reach the secular audience?
She changed, she really didn't change the message as much as she just changed the sound. I mean, gospel music, even back before Sister Tharpe, when Thomas A. Dorsey, who's considered the father of gospel music, also from Georgia, not far from Atlanta, actually lived in Atlanta for a while, gospel music has always sort of blended the sound of the city, whatever was the predominant African-American popular music style with religious lyrics. And it really was a reaction, I would say, to the sort of austere Protestant hymnody that after a while wasn't necessarily resonating with the African-American churchgoer who wanted songs that were spirit-filled, that spoke to their own situation. And people like Sister Tharpe could get that message across with her earthiness, with her just being just down to earth and speaking from her heart to someone else's heart.
But how about that? Playing in clubs. I mean, were there other artists that followed in this, in the clubs on Saturday night, in the pews come Sunday morning model?
There, you know, not many. That was a very taboo thing. In fact, when Sister Tharpe went and performed in the clubs, she got a lot of flack from the African-American church community who felt you did not serve two masters. Now, Sister Tharpe was really, she probably walked the line better than most and, in fact, was able to not be not lose her audience or lose her gospel career by, you know, spending a little time in the clubs and working with Lucky Millinder and such. She actually, I think, continued to work well in the church community, in part because she really never left the church. You know, that happened to a number of artists where they, you know, the allure of popular music, and as time went on after Second World War, the money was there. It was a challenge to say, do I continue to work the gospel circuit, work in the churches for the Lord, or what happens if somebody offers me $50,000 and I've got a family to feed? It was a very very important decision to make. The grand majority of artists, however, chose to stay in the church.
Yeah, I would encourage listeners to watch videos of her playing. It's just wonderful to see. She's fantastic. And this fierce guitarist combining the sacred and the secular. How did we hear her music and her guitar playing influence rock and roll music and early soul and R&B?
Well, yes. Her guitar playing in particular is vastly significant to rock and roll, in large part because Sister Tharp would go overseas and she would play on tours of Europe, sometimes in the combination of blues artists and sometimes in the combination of gospel artists. And so some of the blues and rock, British invasion artists were hearing her there and emulating her guitar licks for their own. So when you fast forward to people like the Rolling Stones and Cream and Eric Clapton, a lot of those artists heard Sister Tharp in Europe, in England, and decided they were going to take some of her licks for their own.
But this is certainly not a name we hear in the same way that Elvis Presley or Jerry Lee Lewis. These are people often credited for bringing rock and roll to the masses. So to what extent have African Americans in general and Black women in particular been left out of this retelling of the history of rock and roll?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question. I think gospel hasn't gotten the same attention as blues, R&B, soul, but it should. In fact, all the music that we sort of are listening to even now, ultimately, I believe, comes from some part of gospel. I've always said the African American church was the best music school. African American artists, regardless of genre, if they were in church, they were singing in the choir. They were even in the Sunshine Band as little kids. And what that meant was that they were learning music. They were also learning stage comportment, confidence. And so all of these things really taught many lessons that helped artists in the future. So how do you put that aside if you're a Sam Cooke or if you're an Aretha Franklin or you're a James Brown? You can't put that church learning aside and do something else. It's going to be part of you always. And I just think that gospel, that history, that the essence of rock and soul that comes out of gospel has not gotten the attention because gospel has sort of been forgotten in the past. But I think it needs to be given greater credence in terms of its overall contribution to American popular music, period.
That's Bob Maravich, gospel historian who contributed to GPB's upcoming series. It's actually produced at WXPN, but it is airing on GPB coming on Sunday. It's called The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul. And Bob, I really want to pick up on that because just around the time that Aretha Franklin died last fall, I listened to an interview and they had some really early recordings of her singing in church. It was just spellbinding. And of course, you know, for Sister Rosetta Tharpe is known as the godmother of soul. Aretha was its undisputed queen, carved her own path in R&B music and got to the top of the charts. Here's just a little bit of one of her songs, Think.
But it don't take too much time to see what you're doing to me. You better think about what you're trying to do to me, yeah. Think, think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Oh, freedom, 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 freedom.
Bob, how did Aretha build on her gospel base and expand it?
Well, she, she went into pop music fairly early, but she, you know, really what it was is it was right about the time when you really started to hear soul music coming out. And when you listen to Aretha, you hear shades of Clara Ward, who is a famous gospel singer. And I think it spoke to people in in the same way that the gospel music did. And I think this goes back again to Thomas Dorsey recognizing that if people are feeling better, if people are feeling renewed in a secular way through songs about love or songs about relationships, couldn't the same thing happen in the church? And it's a reverse for Aretha. She took that feeling of hope and inspiration in the church and just brought it into the relationship arena, into the secular arena. So it's sort of, it's the same. The interesting thing about black music is that it all does come essentially from the same source. You know, in West Africa, all music was sacred, all music was secular. And so what Aretha did was to tap into that church feeling of enthusiasm and passion and just provide a new set of lyrics. But it touched people the same way listening to the radio or seeing her on television or in live that they would have had in church, just listening to the same kind of sound but with a different lyric.
Yeah, let's listen to how lyrics were used by Mahalia Jackson and that soaring, spirited feeling. She started singing in church in New Orleans and eventually toured around the world with gospel hits. Here is Move On Up a Little Higher, which remains one of the best-selling, in fact, the best-selling gospel records of all time.
We're gonna live on forever.
Reverend Herbert Brewster wrote that song, came out in 1947, projected just strength and transcendence for the African-American community. And he once said these were dangerous things to say, but you could sing them. So how did these gospel songs of the time play into the civil rights struggle?
Well, right. And in fact, that song, you know, I just was thinking about it here in Chicago. It was recorded not far from where I'm sitting. You know, that's the spiritual piece of it. I think gospel, like Move On Up a Little Higher, was... It wasn't a political message overtly, but intrinsically it was. It was a music of empowerment. And here was a woman who exuded passion, saying, we can make this happen. We individually and collectively can make this world better, even if it's just one person at a time. And so gospel music, you know, some of it had a political component, but most of it was more of the sense of what I call a more of a spiritual political aspect, where it was an empowerment of a people to say, enough is enough. We are individuals. We are going to use the language of music to uplift ourselves, and in doing so, hope to turn the hearts of others.
She was also active in the civil rights movement, a favorite of Dr. Martin Luther King, an integral part of the March on Washington. Did other gospel artists use their platform to fight for civil rights?
They did. Mahalia Jackson, certainly one of the most important, but also people like Dorothy Love Coates of Birmingham, Alabama, who not only, you know, marched with Dr. King and did a lot for the civil rights movement, but then later sang songs that were more explicitly political than Mahalia Jackson ever would. A group called the Loving Sisters of Arkansas, they also marched with King. Reverend C.L. Franklin, going back to Aretha, her father, very active. Mavis Staples from here in Chicago and the Staples Singers really supported Dr. King. Mahalia Jackson had a saying one time. She said, there are people who sing and say, and then there are those who do. And she liked the doers. So there, you know, there were some gospel artists, as were in any kind of artists, who were afraid to risk their career by supporting the civil rights movement in fear that they would not be played on radio and so forth. But after 1960, you started to hear that change. And, you know, but there were people like Dorothy Love Coates, Inez Andrews, Mahalia Jackson, the Staple Singers, who not only sang the message, but marched and protested as well.
And one component from gospel that we still hear today is that big, booming gospel choir. Beyonce's used it on stage, Kanye West, Ariana Grande, among many artists who've borrowed the sound. Here's a little bit from Grande's song, God is a Woman. So, Bob, when did this trend really appear in popular music, and why is it still used today?
Well, you know, I sort of trace it back to the 80s. I mean, it probably goes back much further, but I want to talk about I Want to Know What Love Is, when Foreigner brought the New Jersey Mass Choir to back them on that song. And so really, for the first time, you were hearing a secular song, a popular song, with a background of a gospel chorus. And that warms my heart, Virginia, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I am probably one of the most outspoken people in terms of giving the gospel chorus its propers in terms of the history. This is where really gospel started. I mean, there were singers, there were, you know, soloists, but Thomas Dorsey started the first gospel chorus here in Chicago in 1931. And this sound is emblematic of gospel. It has influenced so much, so many people, not only people that came out of the gospel chorus and went on to become singers, soloists, but also it is what we know as gospel oftentimes in popular culture. If we think of gospel, we think of a choir and the powerful sound of that choir, which even if you are an atheist, sometimes can really turn your heart to listen to the wonderful music out of the gospel chorus.
Well, Bob, there's so much more to explore in the series that we're airing on GPB. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Virginia, for having me on.
All right, we're going to go out with a little bit more of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, because we just can't get enough of her. Strange things happening every day. Bob Maravich is founder of the Journal of Gospel Music, and you can hear his contributions. That's on a new show, Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul, the four-part series. It's a documentary series. It starts this Sunday on GPB at 10 o'clock. Now, coming up, we're going to hear from a couple high school students, or one high school student, showing off his theater chops in the Thescon. That's coming up when On Second Thought continues.
There are strange things happening every day. Every day.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We know music holds the power to heal. Mary Gaucher, a singer and songwriter originally from New Orleans, directs that power to veterans. Here's a sample.
They say no man's left behind, but that ain't true. They hate it that they need us, but they do. They lose their fingers, lose their limbs. We try to love them back together again. They say no man's left behind, but that ain't true.
That's the song Stronger Together off Gaucher's album Rifles and Rosary Beads. It's up for Best Folk Album at this weekend's Grammy Awards. Gaucher wrote each track with veterans and military spouses.
The military breaks their heart. We're there when they fall apart. They're hurting places that the eye can't see.
The album arose from Mary's work with an organization called Songwriting with Soldiers, which pairs professional songwriters with veterans. The vets bring their stories, and the songwriters help turn them into music. Each track helps listeners feel and understand the hardships facing vets. According to the latest figures from the VA, roughly 20 veterans take their own lives each day. Chuck Reese, host of the Bitter Southerner podcast, talked with Mary about the album and her mission to give veterans a voice. Gaucher has an incredible ability to connect with others who've experienced trauma. In fact, she says music helped her through her own trauma with alcoholism.
For me, songs and songwriting helped save my life. You know, I really struggled with drug addiction and alcoholism. And once I got sober, I needed something to hold on to. And then, you know, 8 records into my career, I was asked to write with veterans. And I'm sitting with people in front of me who don't understand what the hell just happened. In many ways, they're experiencing the confusion of trauma that leaves you almost speechless. There's just no words. And so having been there in my own, with my own trauma, I felt as though it was just the natural fit for me to help them find words for what they've been through. We belong to each other. And it's very easy not to know that once you've been traumatized.
I pray that you are right. I pray that music is part of our path out of all these messes we find ourselves in, not just in the South, but all over the world. And let's start with Still on the Ride. Let's take a listen.
Guardian angels, maybe they're true. My guardian angel, maybe it's you. I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone.
Still on the Ride is a song you wrote with Josh Gertz. And Josh is a disabled veteran. He lives in New York State. He served 5 years in the Army. And in 2003, he was injured in Iraq by a roadside bomb. He suffers from a spinal cord injury and a traumatic brain injury. He can walk, but he says not very far and not for very long. He said that transitioning to civilian life has been difficult.
I just think that with all the new perspective that I found from writing with Mary has helped me to realize there's hope, you know. So if I can pull myself out of, you know, a place where I was attempted suicide and was going to attempt it again to such a brighter and happier place mentally, then why can't I do it physically?
I mean, I heard that, and it sort of blew me away that he found the experience not only transformational in terms of working out what his soul needed, but it helped him take a newer, more optimistic perspective on his physical body's recovery, too.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I think I should say that Josh is an incredible young man. He is a beautiful example of what I call a resilience of the human spirit. He's been through one of the most traumatic stories I've ever heard, and that includes in my recovery working with addicts for the last three decades. Josh has been through an unbelievable amount of trauma. And so for him to experience some kind of transformation through the process of writing a song solidifies my belief that songs are magic. But the thing that you got to remember, and I think this is important, is that they have to contain the truth to have the magic intact. And by that, I don't mean the facts. It's not journalism. But what I'm referencing is the emotional truth. What Josh and I wrote was true to the emotion of what he had experienced with the loss of his best friend. And he helped me to understand what he had gone through, and we found our words together. And the magic of the process started to take over. Josh has gone on to do a 422-mile wheelchair ride to benefit. Yes, indeed.
That's
to
awesome.
Benefit Songwriting with Soldiers. And the reason 22 is the last two numbers of the 400-mile ride is because 22 veterans a day are currently committing suicide, and that's the VA statistic. So we have reason to believe it's probably worse than that.
One other thing about Josh that he told us that really sort of hit me in my heart was he talked about just the difficulty of dealing with the death of a comrade in the battlefield. And he talked to us a little bit about what the process of writing the song did for him.
You know, based on certain religions and ideas, you know, with committing murder, is it murder and why wouldn't it be? You know, and I just kind of struggled with that. And Mary and I kind of talked about it, and we kind of came up with the idea with the loss of my friend, how I, you know, I still feel that, you know, he kind of watches over me. You know, if I'm struggling, I kind of look to him because I know what he would say to me. I know that he would motivate me and push me and stuff. And she said, kind of like a guardian angel.
I can't even go. I'm going to cry. Once we had the vision of his best friend who passed away in his arms being his guardian angel, still there with him and protecting him, and they're still on the ride together, we knew we had a song, and we knew we had a good song.
Mary, the next song I want to talk to you about is the title cut.
Morphine dreams, rifles, and rosary beads, yellow smoke, orange haze blowing into my eyes, whistling sunset bombs. I couldn't trust the sky, rivals and rosary beads.
That's the title song from Rifles and Rosary Beads. Mary, you wrote that with Joe Costello, who lives in Michigan. He says he didn't come home with any physical injuries.
When I came home, there was some burden that I knew I had. I just couldn't figure out what it was. And I didn't have the toolkit to articulate difficult emotions, but I also didn't have a good network of people that understood what I was going through, and the public in general didn't really want to talk about anything that veterans were experiencing when I returned home. That's why I think projects like Songwriting with Soldiers are so remarkable, because they offer that space.
One of the things that strikes me is how when veterans come home, they can feel so divorced from society back home, and sometimes from their own families.
Well, it's even worse. A lot of times they feel divorced from themselves. And I think what Joe was getting at is he had a very hard time reconciling who he believed himself to be with who he became during a war. And I think there's a whole field of knowledge that works on this and tries to help our veterans with what they call moral injury, which is something that happens during war. We're in a position that we're putting them in a position to act outside of their moral beliefs. And that is very hard for them to reconcile, many of them, when they come home.
Well, and Joe told us he wasn't really prepared for the kind of experience he would have while riding with you. Let's listen to him talk about that.
It was a challenging experience, but such a relief at the same time. I finally felt like there was a civilian that was listening to me, that was hearing me, with free of judgment. There was no room for judgment or evaluating me. That creative process really helped me figure out new possibilities for life.
I have a feeling, and I could be wrong here, that going into such a situation so free of judgment and so willing to listen might be difficult for a lot of songwriters, but you've always struck me, your work has always struck me as coming from someone who had the empathy to pull something like that off.
Well, I take that as a high compliment, and I thank you so much for saying that. I think the thing that the ancients knew, that we sometimes can forget, that songs are magic, and they come from the gods, and they come to help us. They're not just ways to get laid or make money. You know what I'm saying? There's something bigger going on if we allow it into the process, and it's sacred. It's a sacred art form if we allow it to speak through us in truth.
That's Nashville-based singer and songwriter Mary Gaucher. She spoke with Chuck Reese, host of the Bitter Southerner podcast, a collaboration between GPB and the Bitter Southerner magazine. You can subscribe at bittersoutherner.com.
Me and my guardian angel were still on the ride.
This weekend, Columbus, Georgia takes center stage for the annual Georgia Thespian Conference. 5,000 high school theater students will gather there for performances, workshops, and fundraising. John Bush is a senior at Gainesville High School, also a state and international thespian officer, joining us on the line from Columbus. Good morning, John. Hello, John. Are you there?
I am with you. Hello.
So was that just all a dramatic entrance to drum up your appearance on our show this morning? We couldn't hear you.
I know. I couldn't hear y'all either.
Well, I'm very, very glad you're here. But so what did it make you want to participate in plays when other kids, a lot of them, consider high school the time for sports or singing choir or marching in band, especially here in Georgia?
Well, I've always been somewhat of a performer. My real entrance into theater was actually ventriloquism at a very young age.
Ventriloquism?
Yes.
Is there a big ventriloquism scene there in Gainesville?
Not at all. Not at all, really. I just would watch old Howdy Doody tapes from my grandpa's VHS tape, and I just became inspired to get my own, and that led me to the stage and led me to the acting world, and that slowly became, you know, more theater-oriented, not ventriloquism-oriented.
So you've acted in productions throughout high school, but also branched into directing and sound tech. So what do you like better, behind the scenes or out in front?
You know, that's a very hard question because I think both are extremely necessary. One of my greatest theater experiences has been directing a straight play. But at the same time, I'd be hard-pressed to say I don't enjoy performing. I would say if I had to choose one, I'd go with performing, but would heavily miss the sound technician side and the directing side or any of that.
But this is going to be your fourth Georgia Thespian Conference, and as an international thespian officer, you've traveled to conferences all over the country and the world. What's the best part about attending these conferences?
The community. You know, seeing just a large group of high schoolers who are all so different. We have a very cosmopolitan culture here, or just anywhere in the thespian society. So when you see people who you wouldn't normally interact with, and then you say, I'm a thespian, Well, you're a thespian too, right? And, mm-hmm. and you have that camaraderie. You have that something that unifies us all, that makes us feel like we belong.
Mm. Keep going. Is it often the case that people don't feel like they belong in their local communities?
Well, not necessarily, but it's just the fact that everyone here completely gets where everyone is coming from when it comes to being a theater kid. Because we have troops of 80, but we have troops of 5 people, right, who come to ThesCon. So to have that experience of like a very small troop being able to be with a big group of thespians just like them, I feel like that's a really important experience for them to have.
So this is your senior, so this is going to be your last ThesCon. What's coming next for you?
I guess college. I guess that would be the next step. but I still have some thespian conferences to attend besides Georgia's. I have. I'm heading to Mississippi and California in the next 2 months, and I'm also going to Washington to advocate for theatrical arts funding at the House of Representatives and the Senate. So there's still some stuff to do with the thespians, but as far as Georgia thespians go, this is my last hurrah, really. It's pretty sad.
Well, have a fun time, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Of course. Goodbye. Thank you for having me. Appreciate
John Bush.
It.
He's Gainesville High School senior, Georgia Thespian Society officer. He and 5,000 other students are in Columbus this weekend at the Georgia Thespian Conference. Well, we'll leave you with that inspiring thought as we say goodbye. Have a great weekend. This is On Second Thought.